and welcome back to Hysteria Radio, where we're always talking music, writing, and all expressive arts and anything that has to do with mental health. Today, we have a guest. He's got a long resume, so hold on a second. I met Zach up at NAMI New York a couple months ago, and we did a talk together, and I found out that he plays piano on Broadway for Wicked. He's played for Motown and The Color Purple. He's a composer. He is a songwriter. He wrote his own musical called Inside My Head. He is also currently working on a docuseries that highlights the link between creativity and mental health conditions called Insanely Talented. And today's guest is Zach Sandler. What's up, Zach?
Hey, Joe.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing good. You got a lot going on, man. Keeping busy.
Yeah, man. It's exciting times.
So how's everything been going in the mental health world? I know that you said that you first started speaking when we met up in, I think it was November, up in Albany.
Yeah, so I first started speaking about mental health just over a year ago, which was actually a podcast as well. That was a podcast called This Is Actually Happening, which is syndicated with NPR, and a friend of a friend basically runs it. So that was the first time I'd ever spoken about it. And that was anonymous, but it still got me interested in the idea of talking about it. And then after I did the previous version of my musical, which was then called A Bit Too Much About Me, one of my friends who saw the show said, you've got to get in touch with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And he connected me there. And so it was in April, I started going to meetings. It's called the Young Professionals Advisory Board, which they have here in New York City.
Oh, wow.
And April was my first meeting. And the national convention was coming up that June, July. And I had this dream in my head of speaking at the convention because I kind of had this bigger dream in my head of giving a TED talk about mental health. And that seemed like a great first step. So it turned out that they needed an alternate, and I expressed my strong interest. I got the alternate position, and then turned out somebody had to leave. So I got to speak at the national convention, which was the first time I spoke as me about mental health.
Wow. And so going back, when did you first realize that there was something going on with your mental health?
So it came on completely out of the blue. When I was in college, it was my junior year up at Yale, and I was 20. And what happened was I'd had this situation where I was very involved in two activities, which were musical theater and a cappella. And I'd become the music director of my a cappella group. Now at Yale, it's basically the frat scene is actually just a cappella groups.
Wow.
It's a very intense thing, and if you're elected one of the leaders of the group, you're pretty much expected to do nothing else. And so I was elected the music director, as they call it, the pitch pipe of the group, which was called the Spizwinks. And yeah, of course, they pretty much expected me to do nothing else other than my classes, and even that was in question.
So they just wanted you to do an a cappella group 24/7 and like dedicate all your time to that, basically, and not, don't really worry about school or having like a social life or anything.
Well, the a cappella group kind of is a social life.
Oh, okay. All right.
Those guys would hang out all the time. And that was a joke about classes. Of course, we're still doing classes and all that. But in terms of other extracurricular activities, that was kind of the expectation.
Oh, okay.
But I still had and still have the theater bug. And so I got into a situation where I had auditioned for the main stage musical, which was Urinetown. And then basically, you know, immediately after, just called them back and said, sorry, like I can't do it. I have this other commitment. And I thought, okay, well, that's the end of it. You know, it's a little bit sad about it, but ready to move on. And then I got this call from the music director a few days later saying, you know, we know you dropped out. We know you didn't come to callbacks, but we still want to cast you as one of the leads.
Oh, wow.
And I was like totally surprised because I'd never been a lead in a main stage musical. And so it presented this dilemma. And I remember, you know, having a meeting with the business manager of the group and him basically saying, if you take this role, then we're going to have to replace you as music director. And that was a really hard choice for me. And I remember deciding to go with the group, turn down the role. And, you know, I know it sounds kind of silly in retrospect, but I think there was something about, you know, like having to give up something that I really loved, that was a trigger for me. And so I became depressed for about, I don't know, a few days to a week. And I remember just kind of dragging myself around campus, feeling sad and despondent and, you know, kind of like low energy.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was pretty unusual for me. I'm usually pretty high energy and kind of doing something all the time. And then I can remember, I was also sick at the time. I had a cold or something like that. So I was on DayQuil, and I remember going to a football game, it's a Yale-Princeton game, and somehow, like, on the walk back from the game, I started feeling more energized, almost like this switch had been flipped. Huh. You know, almost like part of my brain was like, you know what? This depression thing sucks. Like, we're going to try something else.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, like, this is the strategy we're going to use. So it flipped into this energetic state, which initially manifested more of a social way. I remember going to a party with the Princeton a cappella group. It was an all-girls group. And, like, flirting with a lot of girls and kind of, you know, feeling like I was the man on camp, big man on campus. And, you know, everybody was interested in me, even though they probably weren't, because nobody went home with me.
It's college. Everyone's, give yourself some credit. Everyone's interested in everyone in college.
Yeah, well, I guess that's true. So that was how it first came out. And then, you know, I remember kind of like having all these thoughts that started spinning, coming more quickly and becoming more grand. And I remember starting up this Word document, and it was this manifesto about philosophy and psychology and politics. And it was called My Religion. And, you know, at the time it was like, oh, like, these are all, you know, brilliant insights that no one's ever had before. And it all connected in my head, like the different thoughts, like, made complete sense together.
Yeah.
And basically I ended up staying up most of 3 nights in a row. I think I would go to bed around 6 a.m., get about 3 hours of sleep, and then go through my whole day, do it again. And I think that the guys in my group kind of could tell something was a little off. And I remember one night I got really paranoid because I heard people coming up an entryway that nobody ever went up. And so I thought that there were people trying to break in. And I actually called the campus police on my roommate because of that. And so that was like sort of a weird sign for me. And then the turning point was I called my parents one night to tell them about something I had discovered, which was about an apple and how simple and elegant an apple is and why and what the symbolism of the apple is.
The old,
and I remember my dad,
late night description of an apple call. That's, I've had, I don't think I ever used an apple, but I'm sure I've had some late night calls to family and friends that were, yeah, that they were wondering after.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, my dad's a psychiatrist, and he immediately was like, you know, I don't think he said bipolar or manic, but he immediately knew that something was off. And so my parents and my brother, who happened to be in town with them, just hopped in the car and drove through the night. up to Connecticut, and when I woke up, they were there. And yeah, and basically it just spiraled from there, you know, from going to lunch with them, to going to the psychiatrist at Yale, to, you know, basically being told that I couldn't leave, even though I had no sense of how serious it was.
Told that you couldn't leave college or the hospital?
I couldn't leave the doctor's office. They wanted me to go to the hospital.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I really didn't want to go. Yeah, I remember by this point I had printed out the entire manifesto, which was 39 pages long.
Wow.
And I had written in pencil on the back of it all these like diagrams and figures, and I had this diagram of a triangle that was reducing from 3 points into a single point. And I did that last part while I was in the waiting room to go see the doctor, and I was convinced that I had reduced the universe to a single point with my theory. And it was, you know, around that moment that they brought me back and basically said, you have to go to the hospital. Like, you don't have a choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was really upset, you know, because I felt like if I just had a little time to, if I had a little time to take a walk and just settle down, you know, kind of release these thoughts, that I could come back to a baseline state. And I know I still believe that I could have done that. But as you said, I had no choice. So, I ended up going to the hospital and having a very crazy night, for lack of a better word, in the hospital, where I really got pretty psychotic there, and, you know, was believing that the doctors were trying to kill me with medicines they were giving me, and that if I took these medicines, they'd make me go to sleep, and then if I went to sleep before the sunrise, then I would die. And so that was the paranoia, which we'll, you know, talk about with the show. And then the other big thing was the grand visions. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, it takes on a religious nature, which is interesting, you know, because I, at that time in my life, I was definitely considering myself an atheist. And in fact, my favorite book was The God Delusion, which is, you know, if you've ever read it, it's like searing indictment of religion anywhere. And at this point in my life, I consider myself very spiritual, and, you know, it's different, but back then, not religious at all. And yet when I was in the hospital, I had these religious visions where I was convinced that another patient was God and another patient was Mother Mary. And then the most remarkable thing of all was that around 2 a.m, all these patients started coming out of their rooms. And I remember the hospital staff saying, like, what's going on? This has never happened before. Like, you know, there must have been 20 patients in the common area. Uh-huh. And they were all just like standing there, sitting there looking at me. And, uh-huh. And then I remember a few of them, like several different ones, saying that I was Jesus.
Wow. That's,
and, you know, coming from a guy who it was raised Jewish and was an atheist.
Wow. That's I have to tell you, a lot of your symptoms, I mean, I didn't have them in as quick a period. It sounds like all this happened to you within like a week or two. You know, the switch flip, you wrote your manifesto, you ended up in the hospital. I mean, but I see your story like spread out over like a couple years in my story, and it's really amazing.
Oh.
I could picture, as you tell like where you were when that switch flipped, I can picture myself walking in LA and that switch flipping, and then when you were in the hospital in the doctor's office with your family, I see myself back in Westchester at the doctor's office with my family. And same thing when, mm-hmm. When you go to the hospital, I picture myself in a couple different hospitals, and it's just I could see why you're a really good writer, because the way that you just tell the story, I can envision every part of it. And so what happened with the music and the theater at this time? Were you still making music? Was music making things worse? Because I think for me, for a while, music like made it, it helped me, but I don't think it helped the symptoms because I was reaching really far for my creativity.
That's interesting. Yeah. Because in general, I actually don't go towards music when I'm feeling manic. I go towards philosophy and ideas. But that first time when I was in the hospital, you know, basically I ended up staying up all night. And when the doctors came in the morning, they gave me an injection. You know, it was pretty traumatic. They like forced me into a chair, like five of them, you know, and then the doctors gave me an injection of Haldol and then I think Thorazine and I think Zyprexa and like a bunch of other things.
Which is
completely knocked me out.
Yeah, that's a traumatic experience all on its own.
No. And then they put me in the solitary room, which I didn't notice for the first day because I slept for 24 hours.
Yeah.
Or at least I don't remember being awake. And, you know, then like the next day they let me out, but it was, you know, that was pretty traumatic as well. But by the time I came out of the grogginess of, you know, recovering from the manic state and also the medicines, I actually felt pretty clear and not at all psychotic and very grounded. And so I think I was in the hospital for 5 days. And, you know, those first 2 or 3 days, I actually wrote 2 songs in the hospital.
Wow.
And one of them was called Control. And it was basically an expression of my anger at the doctors for taking control over me and over my body and mind. And it's kind of like an angsty rock song. And I also wrote a song called Floors, which I don't remember as well, but it was about the floors there. And I also remember there was a male patient who played guitar and he had a guitar and a female patient who was a singer. So like the three of us got together and jammed and that was really fun. So yeah, in that episode, the music, I would say, helped me pull out of it and helped me process what happened.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. So take me to when you start the healing process. Like, is it when you get out of this hospitalization or were there more bumps in the road after that?
Yeah, so the initial healing, you know, it turned out that this happened right before Thanksgiving. So when I got out of the hospital, I went home for Thanksgiving break. And there I experienced a huge amount of anxiety with leaving the house. And I think it was because I didn't trust my brain anymore because I felt like it had attacked me, essentially.
Yeah.
This part I didn't know existed just kind of sprung out. And so that initially happened with driving. I was trying to drive to the grocery store, which was 5 minutes away, and I just couldn't go more than a block because I was so anxious. So, but I decided to go back to school, finish the semester, and my mom actually came with me and stayed on campus with me for the entire rest of the semester, which was unbelievable. I mean, it truly saved my semester.
Wow.
And I got through it. I, you know, did well in my classes. And my anxiety started going down. And then there was like a whole big decision of whether to come back for the spring semester. And my psychiatrist up in New Haven was very adamant that the sooner I could get back on the horse, the better it would be, the easier it would be.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that I listened to him because it was really a godsend to come back because after the first few days of anxiety, it like kind of melted away. Other than a little anxiety for performances and anxiety for driving when I was home, that continued for a while. But in terms of manic symptoms, depressive symptoms, I was pretty much in the clear for about 8 years after that first episode.
Okay. So was that your freshman year that all that happened?
It was junior year.
Junior. Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. That's unbelievable. And, so Inside My Head is the musical that you wrote recently.
That's right. Actually, I'm still writing it.
Oh, still writing. Oh, okay. No, I saw some clips. That was your other musical that you wrote?
Well, the musical Inside My Head is the new version of a show that was called A Bit Too Much About Me.
Right, right. Okay, so that's what I saw the clips of. Okay.
Yeah.
Is that about this time of your life?
Partly, yes. So yeah, A Bit Too Much About Me was really sort of a concert hybrid musical that was literally my story. And I was playing the piano, narrating my own story. And there was an actor playing me when I was younger. And the trick was that in the end, he becomes me and I take over the story for the last 5 minutes of the show. And so that version had the mental health theme, and you had the three characters inside his head. You had the paranoia, you had the religious visions, and those would only come out during the manic episodes. And I've had two major manic episodes, so those are both portrayed in the show, pretty much true to life. And then the third character was called Charlie, which is basically the bipolar part of my brain. And in that version, he was really just playing the manic part of my brain. Wow. So he was kind of like a showman, like, hey, like, you're the greatest in the world. Like, you can do all this stuff. And there was a song, actually, it's a song that I played when we first met. There was a song called On Your Mind.
Yes.
Which occurred early in the show where Charlie's basically saying, you know, I'm here, like, I don't want to just be in your head, I want to be on your mind. And it's kind of like, you know, I mean, you know, it's kind of like a power ballad, basically.
Yeah, yeah, and which was really funny because there was four of us speaking that day, and three of us that weren't going were lined up in the front. And I was right next to the piano. So as you were like singing this basically into my ear, this power ballad of the three people that are inside your head, all I could think about was like, oh my God, like I've been there before. Like I've had this guy who's now physically like right in front of me singing into my ear. Like I've had days where I've walked around, you know, the streets of LA and walked, you know, or, you know, paced up and down my house, having those same screaming thoughts replaying over and over again in my head. I just thought that was really funny. I felt like everything had come full circle that day because I was like, wow, I was like, now this has come to fruition. Like this thing that was only my imagination is now right in front of me. It was really interesting. So
that's awesome. I'm happy to hear you had that experience. I think.
Good part
when
of
we share our stories. Sorry, go ahead. I was gonna say, I find like when we share our stories, like there's always, you know, people who it resonates with or strikes some kind of chord, and that connection that you can find between people who have had experiences like this or know someone who has, it's really cool. It's almost a sense of community, I think.
Yeah, totally. That's every time I read somebody's story or hear them speak, something else clicks. And I either remember something that happened in my story or, you know, we connect on so many different levels and so many different ways that exactly what happens with you doesn't exactly have to happen with me for even to even understand it, basically, you know. And I think that's what's amazing.
Yeah.
About the writing and the music and with everyone that I've talked to on this show so far, there's a part of their story that when I walk away, I'm like, wow, I feel better about what happened to me because I thought I was the only one that went through that. Or, you know, not that what happened to either of us was good, but there's something that happens and something that heals inside you when you know that you weren't the only one to go through something. And that's why I love that the work that you're doing now and the writing that you're doing now is all about mental health, and you've immersed yourself in it, because so many artists that, you know, like mainstream artists or pop artists, they talk about the struggle in their song, but then they never talk about it in real life. So it's like, it's left up to imagination, and then media tears it apart, and they're like, oh, it must have been about this relationship, or it must have been about, and we let media basically tell the story rather than allow the artist to tell the story. And that always baffles me. So there's something that's happening within like the NAMI and This Is My Brave community and like the Peace Love Organization community, where the artist is telling the whole story. I mean, they're creating the art, they're giving the backstory, you know, they're doing their own media. They don't have a publicist filter. And it's something about like real work that I just, I can't get enough of it. And I think it's taking art to a whole nother level. That's just awesome right now.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, you know, at this point, you know, if you Google me, you're going to find out I'm bipolar. I actually, I just updated like my LinkedIn bio and my bio on my personal website and my bio on the Directory of Contemporary Musical Theater, where you can buy sheet music. That bio, so all those now say that I'm bipolar. And my Facebook also, you know, I posted the speech from Albany and said, I'm bipolar. So now it's this, you know, very freeing feeling of like, okay, this is me and this is what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
But, you know, it wasn't always that way. It's not easy. You know, I had a day job for about a year and a half and never told a soul about it. And I really wanted to, but, you know, I was afraid of getting fired. And
yeah,
I kind of felt like I was, you know, closing in on telling them just because my musical was starting to develop and they were going to start hearing about it and they'd figure out anyway. But, you know, it ended before we got to that point. So I never ended up disclosing. But at this point, any future employer is going to know.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you.
I'm sort of like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
If you don't want to work with me for that, then, you know,
then we're probably not. Yeah, then we probably shouldn't work together. That's
yeah. So yeah, and I think the new version of the show, Inside My Head, it's interesting because it's still based on my story, but it's not me anymore. So I'm creating circumstances that I think are universal that come from my story, and the biggest change is to have those characters inside of his head to be present through the entire show, not just the episodes. So now we have a character playing his anxiety. And, you know, we all have anxiety at some point.
Yeah.
So his anxiety is this woman, and she's always there, always talking into his ear, like, you're not a good singer. Like, what are you thinking? What are you doing? You know, and then you have the character who's playing his dreams, which are always there for most of us, not all of us. And so he's always saying, you know, Broadway, you can play on Broadway, you can do better, you're awesome. All right. And then in the episode, they become these extreme versions, the paranoia and the grand vision. And then there's also the character of the bipolar, which I'm calling MD, which stands for manic depression. In the show, you won't find that out till the end. So, you know, don't tell anyone.
I won't.
But,
you hear that, listeners? Don't tell anyone.
but yeah, the interesting thing we found is how to show that character is both responsible for his creativity and his psychosis. So basically, when the episode starts, this character actually sits down at the piano and starts playing different music that drives the episode.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Unbelievable how you were able to separate all this and clarify it and get it from your head, you know, onto paper, and then now putting on a show with people. It's that amazes me, because I, you know, I have a lot of projects, you know, that are in my head or only one page out of 300 is written. And I find it hard to finish things that go into the details. You know, for me, the poetry is easy because it's just taking my thoughts and getting them down. But as far as creating like this picture, I've had problems where I started writing a book about everything that I went through with LA and the hospitals, like 2009 or so. And I wrote a chapter and I just needed to take a break. And I stepped away. This was probably over the summer and I haven't gone back to it yet because it was just like too vivid for me to go back to right away. And the fact that you're able to do that over and over again, it looks like is really unbelievable. And, you know, it inspires me to go back. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think the thing for me, and this is one thing I like talking about publicly, is in the last 3 years, I've not had a single full-blown episode. And I think that's largely because 3 years ago, after my second manic episode, I was like, you know what? This is a part of who I am. Like, I am bipolar. This is part of me. And once I made that decision to self-accept, it completely changed the game, because then the next time I had symptoms of hypomania coming on, I could say, oh, okay, yeah, this is that thing that happens for me, and I'm going to take control of it. So I'm going to take some risperidone or some Klonopin, which are the two medicines that really work for me to stop mania. I'm going to call my doctor, call my family, talk about it. I'm going to get sleep. I'm going to stop writing for a little while so it doesn't drive it further. And, you know, I've had like probably 6 or 7 of these hypomanic episodes in those 3 years, but never gotten out of control. And I think that was a big part of it.
Yeah. And I think that's everything, is being able to catch yourself, you know, before you fall too far. And whether that's with meds or, you know, some kind of other routine, you know, a lot of people, you know, people ask me like, what do I need to do to not get depressed or not get manic? And it's really whatever works for you, right? Like whether it's meds or working out or running or hiking or, you know, getting a service animal or, I mean, I don't know, the list, right? Like the infinite list of things that we can do. And it's really just whatever works for you. And for me, it's the same. I mean, I have to take meds every night. I take Seroquel every night. And right now, like, I don't even mind, you know, it doesn't really hold me back during the day. Like, and it keeps the mania and depression away. So why wouldn't I take it, you know? But I do notice a difference when I stop writing for a while. Like I notice that I start to slip a little bit, or if I'm not going for walks or if I'm not getting outside. So it's just like the combination of whatever works for you. And it's great that you found that combination and you know what to start doing when you feel yourself slip a little bit. That's really, I think, you know, people hate the term recovery. And I don't understand why, because all that is for me is like, that means I need to follow some guidelines. And if I feel like I'm slipping in my recovery, that doesn't mean like my life is going to hell and everything's going to fall apart. But if I don't label this something, then how do I know when I'm falling? You know, and it's
interesting.
So that's my, tangent for the day.
Yeah. Well, I have 2 thoughts on that. Like, in my experience, I have, like, it's not been possible to prevent symptoms from starting. Like, you know, just like I can't prevent feeling happy or sad or guilty or angry. Like, the feelings are going to start.
Right.
But the thing that I've learned to do is to manage them so that they don't get out of control.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm not doing that as well with anger and sadness, but, you know. But I'm doing that with
you know what? Who is depression. Who is somebody who claims that they're not living with any mental health issues or problems or disturbances or whatever, you know, anyone wants to call it, like, they're having trouble managing their anger and anxiety and depression too. So, you know, don't.
Yeah.
At some point, you know, when I started recovery after my last hospitalization, or actually, well, I had a hiccup, as they call it, in 2013. But after 2011, I was in for like 40 something days at one point. And And when I got out, I remember everyone would start getting nervous, like whenever I felt. And I was like, no, 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 like living, you know, with a mental health condition doesn't mean that I can't ever be happy or sad. It was like, if I had a good day, it was like, oh, are you getting manic? And if I was having a bad day, it was like, oh, are you getting depressed? And, you know, we still get to feel like you can't just give us Haldol the rest of our lives and put us in a corner. Like, that's not how life works. And it took a while for me to understand why, when I'd go to like a family event, right? Like, I'd go to like Christmas or Thanksgiving or a birthday, and like people are screaming and yelling and drinking, and I'd be sitting there all calm, and I'd be like, well, this looks like mania to me. But it's like, I guess because like they go to work and have the relationship and, you know, see their friends, it's not mania for them. But I always thought that, like, you know, a drunken party looked pretty manic to me. So it's like, why was I always being singled out?
Well, yeah, I think that these, you know, mania and depression are just magnified versions of things that everybody experiences at some point. So your party may well have been a bit manic.
It may have been. But that's why I am sober these days. So that way, you know, for me, that's another big thing. It's that only adds to the ups and downs for me. So, and I was never a drinker. I never
drinking.
Yeah, so I never tolerated it well, but I loved marijuana when I was younger. And it's just right now, you know, ups and downs are just not even needed in my life. But who knows? Yeah. Who knows? Maybe they were manic.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, the word recovery. Like, I think I would apply that to myself for like when I've been recovering from an acute manic episode, like, you know, the first couple weeks out of the hospital, something like that. I know it's also sometimes used in a more general sense, like for years after you've been diagnosed or something. And I haven't thought about this term as much. Like, I think more about the terms like illness and disorder, which I've pretty much stopped using. So, I, you know, because those two words, to me, they imply there's something wrong with me,
right,
and that needs to be fixed or changed. And I don't believe that there is anything wrong with me. I think that actually it's kind of a gift. You know, it does have its challenges, but it doesn't feel right to pathologize it. So now I talk about just having bipolar. I talk about mental conditions or mental health. And so, yeah, I wonder, I think recovery is, it doesn't feel as dangerous to me. But I could also see how it could make it sound like it's something to be cured or fixed. You know what I mean?
Right, right, right. Yeah. And I totally agree with I don't like the term mental illness either. It, like, it's exactly what you said, but the only thing that I was thinking is, would I have gotten insurance when I was in the hospital? Like, because I had no money, no anything. And would they have given me insurance if I didn't have an illness? That's the only thing I'm wondering. But so for insurance purposes, they can call it whatever they want. I would never label somebody mentally ill or even any of those words, you know, disorder, mental illness. It makes it, like you said, implies that something's wrong with their character or that they did something wrong, like behavioral health. You know what? It's not a behavioral problem. It's a chemical imbalance. It's a disconnect with society. Who knows what it is? You know, it's so many different things, but it's not a behavior problem. Like, we're not children. And that one
always
got me. So
And I wouldn't let the insurance industry dictate my vocabulary.
Exactly. Let them call whatever they want. Just pay for my hospital stay.
As long as I'm paying the premium, you know.
Yeah. So let's get to Insanely Talented, which I had the pleasure of being a part of, and really an amazing project, this documentary series that you started. Why don't you tell us about Insanely Talented?
Yeah, so Insanely Talented is a docuseries about the link between mental conditions and creativity. And the goal is to basically, for each episode, we tell two different people's stories, one a celebrity artist and one an up-and-coming artist, both incredibly talented people, both with mental conditions. And we'll tell one of their stories, kind of a docu form, the other one, and then sort of interweave the stories at their connection points. And then we also will always include a performance of their work. So if it's a musician, they might play a song. If it's a painter, they might present a painting, or we might show the process of them painting it. And then in the end, we have the two artists collaborate on something. So that's the premise. And currently we are in production. As we said, as you said, you know, you were our incredible first guest, and we've gone ahead with a second guest and looking towards the third.
Nice.
And basically hoping to get it on Netflix or Amazon or that kind of place.
That's awesome. It was, yeah, I can't wait to start showing people, because it was really, it was a pleasure to put together. And you and Tyler, who filmed it, you guys did an awesome job putting it together. And everything is just, you know, I felt like I was, you know, there's so many like YouTube series out right now, which are great, but like this was really professional, but had like the raw content of like a YouTube series. So it was like the best of both worlds as far as, you know, the quality went. And I'm just, you know, anything that's spreading the word, a positive message about mental health, telling people to do, you know, to go with their passion and to just put themselves out there and be themselves. It's, I'm all about it. So
thank you, Joe. Yeah. And I definitely want to give a shout out to Tyler Milliron, who is producing the series with me. He's got an incredible production company called Milliron Studios, which is here in New York City. If anyone out there has any kind of video needs, whether it's audition tapes or you know, a video blog or anything, I highly recommend him.
Yeah.
He's done a few projects with me and it's fantastic.
Yeah. Tyler did an awesome job. And, I'm really looking forward to see somebody else though, other than myself. But well, yeah, we'll definitely be looking out for Insanely Talented. And, so let's go on to getting near the end. What advice do you have for someone that doesn't think their writing is good enough?
Keep writing.
Yeah.
This was said to me when I was 22 by a producer. And I was talking to a producer about my writing, and his advice was keep writing. And at the time it sounded, you know, kind of obvious, but, you know, it's taken until very recently for it to sink in, you know, now, because what would happen is, you know, I would be music directing or playing piano for a living, teaching, and I would not have time to write. So I would end up only writing here and there.
Uh-huh.
And what I've learned as I've prioritized writing in the last few years is that I just need to write every day, you know, even if it's only for 15 minutes, even if it's terrible, I just need to write something.
Yeah.
You know, some days I'll write for 3 hours and some days I'll write for 15 minutes. But it's just the process of doing it that gets kind of all the crap out of the way so you can get to the good stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's the first thing. And the second thing I would say is to really try and find a subject that speaks directly to you.
Uh-huh.
I spent a lot of time writing shows that were really, that were like these bigger stories that I wanted to tell, but weren't about me. So I had a musical called A Question of Faith, and I was basically trying to make a point about, you know, the differences between America and Iraq and, you know, how we're sort of all people, then like how we could find middle ground. And so the story of this college age couple from Kansas and this guy from Iraq, and a basically love triangle story. And, you know, it was a fun project, but like none of these people were anything like me.
Right.
And so I had trouble moving it forward. And in the last couple of years, you know, since I've been working on what's now inside my head, which was literally my story and characters basically from my life. And so that has allowed me to really write what I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the thing about this show is nobody knows it better than I do.
That's it.
So I feel like I can actually bring something unique to the world through this piece of art. And yeah, so keep writing, write every day, and find material that really speaks to you. You know, I don't think you have to necessarily write about yourself, but if you're able to find yourself in the character of your writing, that's the key.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. I think it gives the writing so much more power when it comes straight from your heart. And if you can relate to the experiences as the writer, that makes it better for your readers, I think, to relate to the experiences, you know. And
yeah.
I think that's awesome advice. Awesome advice.
And I guess the last thing I would say.
Oh, okay.
You know, because there's a lot of rejection. You know, you're submitting to all these things and you get rejected from almost all of them. And so I found that I have to kind of approach it with some lightness and basically say, you know, I really want to do this. This would be cool. But if not, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and then I've actually found that the more I'm able to say whatever, the more things happen. Huh. I think it's this weird thing about how the universe works that if you hold too tightly to something that you want, the universe can't grab it and give it to you. You have to be able to let it go and hold it lightly.
Great advice. I couldn't think of a better way to end the interview on that. Why don't you give us any links or anywhere that we can find your work, anything that you're doing soon, anything you want to promote right now? The floor is yours.
Thank you, Joe. Well, my personal website is zacksandler.com, ZAKSANDLER. And there you can find videos of my work, audio tracks. You can find a video of my speech at NAMI New York State. And you can find sheet music, songs I've written. And you can also find a link to the show website for A Bit Too Much About Me, which is just abittoomuchaboutme.com. And that site's a little out of date. As you know, it's now inside my head. But you can find a 5-minute video highlight reel of the show at abittoomuchaboutme.com, as well as some audio tracks and bios for the original cast and creative team. And let's see. I have a performance coming up March 5th. And that's going to be here in New York City at the Green Room 42. I'll be presenting one of my songs called He Smiles, which is from Inside My Head. And it's actually been floating around for about 7 years. And let's see. I had another thing. What is it? Oh, yes. Well, if you wanted to hear my original podcast, which I'm very proud of as well, you cannot find it under my name because it was anonymous. But if you search for This Is Actually Happening, and I believe it's episode 85, What If You Had Bipolar Disorder? Yeah, back then we were still using the word disorder. And that's about a 30-minute long interview. So, yeah, I think that's about it for now. There's a few other projects I'm working on. The City of Ember, it's an adaptation of the young adult novel, A World That's Underground But Doesn't Know They're Underground, and the two teenagers who lead the way out to the world above. So that's in the works. And a show that I wrote called Anthem, which is a song cycle about why we sing the national anthem. And each song is based on a real letter written during an American war. So there's a song from Revolutionary War, there's a song from the Civil War, a song from the Afghanistan War, etc. And each song contains a fragment of the lyric of the national anthem. And in the end of the show, they all weave together into the anthem. So I think that's a very topical show these days.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's pretty much what's going on.
He's a busy man.
Yeah. I mean, also, like, you know, if there's any listeners who want to get in touch in terms of talking more about mental health, like personal situation, talking about writing, music, like, I'd be happy to do that. Can I give my email on the air?
Sure, if you want, or if they want to email us, we can give it to them too. But yeah, you can, if you want to give it out, you can give it out. That's fine.
Yeah, happy to. So it's just my name, Zach, Z-A-K dot Sandler, S-A-N-D-L-E-R, at gmail.com. I'd be more than happy to chat.
Awesome. Well, Zach, thank you very much for today. And we're going to keep up with all your work, because you're doing a lot of it. And I'm sure I'm going to be seeing you at a lot of NAMI events over the years. And This Is My Brave events over the years, and all kinds of other stuff. Yeah. Where we're going to keep coming in contact. And thank you very much for sharing your story with us today. And I encourage all of our listeners to go check out Zach's work, because it's really awesome. And he's doing some great things in the art and the mental health community right now. So thank you very much, Zach.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe.
All right. Anytime. We'd love to have you back. All right, everyone. That's it for today's episode of Hysteria Radio. Remember to keep the radio up to keep the hysteria down. We'll see you next time.